Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Paying the PTO's Attorney's Fees Edition. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On December 11th, 2019, the Supreme Court decided Peter v. Nantquest Incorporated, a case considering whether a party opting to bring a challenge in federal district court to an adverse decision of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office's Patent Trial and Appeal Board, known as PTAB, must pay the PTO's resulting attorney's fees. When a patent applicant is rejected by the PTO and the PTAB affirms that decision on appeal, the aggrieved applicant may either pursue further, but relatively constrained, review in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, or the applicant may file a more expansive challenge in federal district court. The latter option is authorized by U.S. Code 35, Section 145, but the statute also provides that, quote, all the expenses of the proceeding shall be paid by the applicant, end quote. Here, Nantquest challenged an adverse PTAB decision in federal district court, but lost. After the judgment was affirmed by the Federal Circuit, the PTO sought reimbursement of its expenses from Nantquest, including nearly $80,000 in attorney's fees. The district court denied recovery based on the American rule that parties in federal court typically bear their own fees unless otherwise directed by Congress. A divided en banc panel of the Federal Circuit ultimately affirmed the district court. This decision, however, was in tension with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit's construction of similar language in the Lanham Act. By a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Federal Circuit. Justice Sotomayor, writing for a unanimous court, held that the plain text of Section 145 did not provide the requisite, specific, and explicit indication that Congress had intended to depart from the American rule's presumption against fee shifting. Accordingly, the PTO could not recover attorney's fees from Nantquest under Section 145. And now, to discuss the case, we have Robert J. Rando, founder and lead counsel at the Rando Law Firm, PC. Please note that Mr. Rando is co-counsel on an amicus brief filed on behalf of the Association of Amicus Counsel in this case.
Now, before I get into the decision, a few general observations and brief notes about the parties' arguments. As I had stated when discussing the oral argument, the justices might find themselves in the unfamiliar territory of agreeing with each other and agreeing with the majority of the Federal Circuit en banc opinion, although they often agree with each other on reversing the Federal Circuit in patent cases. And also, that I didn't see a right-left divide or an administrative state divide from the oral argument, and that if the American rule rules the day, all puns intended, we might see a 9-0 affirmance of the Federal Circuit by the Supreme Court, which is exactly what the court did. Also, interestingly, or perhaps not so much, the questions at oral argument focus on the bases that the court articulates for its unanimous decision. So, the government arguments. In their briefing and at oral argument, the government articulated three principal reasons why the answer to the question of including the attorney and paralegal fees in the all expenses should be yes. First, they argued that the term expenses unambiguously encompasses costs that is money paid to employees or other personnel to accomplish a particular task. And unlike the term costs, which has a similarly broad common meaning, the court has not construed the term expenses as a legal term of art with a more limited scope. And as we will see when we get to the court's opinion, the court addresses this argument. Second, that requirements who file suit under Section 145 to pay personnel expenses of the PTO is consistent with the overall statutory scheme that Congress had directed the PTO to charge fees that are sufficient to cover its aggregate operating costs, including personnel expenses. And Section 145 applicants put the PTO to a particular expense, and is therefore consistent with the logic of the statute to require them to pay more. And third, that it's especially appropriate to require Section 145 plaintiffs to pay the PTO's personnel expenses because Section 141 is a direct appeal to the Federal Circuit and is available as an alternative means of obtaining judicial review. And Section 141 is not a cut rate or substandard mode of judicial review, but rather it's an ordinary, on-the-record, APA-style judicial review, and it contains no requirement that the applicant who chooses that course must pay the PTO's personnel expenses. As I previously noted, and will again, since the court in this decision also addresses the issue, there is a bit of hand-waving in that there is and are differences in the two proceedings with respect to the standard of review and availability of introducing additional evidence. And as we argued in our Association of Amicus Counsel amicus brief filed in the case, the Federal Circuit appeal is solely on the administrative record, has a high threshold and deference, whereas the district court proceeding is de novo and provides for inclusion of additional evidence. Now for Nanquist's arguments. For its part, Nanquist made 3 points in oral argument. First, the American rule is a bedrock principle that the court has recognized and applied for two centuries. Second, that the government is arguing for a radical departure from the American rule. It is arguing that when a private party sues the government for its improper action, then that private party must pay for the government's attorneys, even if the government and its attorneys are flatly wrong. Third, there are over 3,000 federal statutory provisions that use the word expenses without any reference to attorney's fees or counsel fees. Some of these provisions are open-ended, as is the case here. The government can point to not a one of those other provisions to say that the word expenses includes attorney's fees, save for the two exceptions, the radical exception that it's arguing here. Okay, for the decision. The court started out by describing the proceeding under Section 145 and also the two distinct paths presented by the de novo review in the district court under 145 and the direct appellate review under Section 141. The court highlighted the differences as significant as contrasted with the government's argument discussed a moment ago. The court noted that, quote, its basic point of reference when considering the award of attorney's fees is the bedrock principle known as the American rule. That is, each litigant pays their own attorney's fees, win or lose, unless a statute or a contract provides otherwise. And that the American rule has roots in our common law reaching back to at least the 18th century. The court also stated that while the government did not dispute the import of the American rule, that it should not apply since the presumption is most often overcome when a statute awards fees to a prevailing party, which is not the case here. Now, I'll pause here to point out that the government argument, as shot down by the court with examples of attorney fee awards to a party notwithstanding a failure to prevail, only exacerbates the absurdity of having a potential prevailing party be required to pay a fee shift to the government. Indeed, the court stated that the government view is incorrect, and that the court has never suggested that any statute is exempt from the presumption against fee shifting, nor has it limited its American rule inquiries to prevailing party statutes. In fact, the court has noted that it developed a line of precedents addressing statutory deviations from the American rule that do not limit attorney's fees awards to the prevailing party. The court also noted that the presumption against fee shifting not only applies, but is particularly important because Section 145 permits an unsuccessful government agency to recover its expenses from a prevailing party. And reading Section 145 to award attorney's fees in that circumstance would, quote, be a radical departure from the longstanding fee-shifting principles adhered to in a wide range of contexts. The court next went on to explain its approach to determine whether Congress intended to depart from the American rule and stated that the court must first look to the language of the section of the statute at hand. And while the absence of a specific reference to attorney's fees is not dispositive, then Congress must provide a sufficiently specific and explicit indication of its intent to overcome the American rule presumption against fee shifting. The court then analyzed Section 145 in three specific contexts. First, it looked at the clarity or lack thereof of the term expenses in a section. Second, it looked at the statutory usage of the term expenses in the section. And third, how the history of the USPTO interpretation of the term expenses and attorney's fees with respect to the statutory provision and the Patent Act was as a whole. Clarity. As for the clarity question, the court found that the reference to expenses in Section 145 does not invoke attorney's fees with the kind of clarity we have required to deviate from the American rule. The court then identified various general definitions of expenses and stated that although the definitions are capacious enough to include attorney's fees, the mere failure to foreclose a fee award, neither specifically or explicitly, authorizes courts to shift the fees. Then, in what I see as having significant implications beyond this case, the court went on to analyze the term expenses alongside neighboring words in the statute to support the conclusion that legal fees were not within the scope of the term. Specifically, the court examined the complete phrase expenses of the proceeding and stated that it is similar to the Latin expensae litis, or expenses of the litigation, a term that has long referred to a class of expenses commonly recovered in litigation to which attorney's fees did not traditionally belong. And also, referring to definitions of the Latin term in Black's and J. Bouvier law dictionaries, concluded that those definitions suggest that the use of expenses in Section 145 would not have been commonly understood to include attorney's fees at its enactment. Finally, the court addressed the modifier all and stated that it does not expand Section 145's reach to include attorney's fees, and that although the word conveys breadth, it cannot transform expenses to reach an outlay it would not otherwise include. And the court cited to its other recent IP case, Rimini versus Oracle, interpreting the term costs in the copyright law, where the court held that the adjective full in the phrase full cost does not alter the meaning of the word costs, but that full costs is limited to all of the costs otherwise available under law, not including attorney's fees. The court concluded that Section 145 plain text does not overcome the American rule's presumption against fee shifting to permit the PTO to recoup its legal personnel salaries as expenses of the proceedings. Next, statutory usage. As for the statutory usage, the court stated that the record of statutory usage also illustrates how the term expenses alone does not authorize recovery of attorney's fees. Specifically, the fact that expenses and attorney's fees appear in tandem across various statutes shifting litigation costs indicates that Congress understands the two terms to be distinct and not inclusive of each other, and that in common statutory usage, the term expenses alone has never been considered to authorize an award of attorney's fees with sufficient clarity to overcome the American rule presumption. Next, the Patent Act's history. In that, the court found that the Patent Act's history reinforces that Congress did not intend to shift fees in Section 145 actions. The court noted that since its inception, there is no evidence that the Patent Office, the PTO's predecessor, originally paid its personnel from sums collected from adverse parties in litigation, or that the office initially even employed attorneys. And that even though salaries of PTO employees might have qualified as an expense of the agency, it does not mean that they are an expense of a Section 145 proceeding. And, hearkening back to Justice Gorsuch's discourse with the government during oral argument, pointed out that until this litigation, the PTO had not sought its attorney's fees under Section 145, and this for over 170 years, and that the agency had managed to pay its attorneys consistently, suggesting that financial necessity does not require reading 145 to shift the fees either. Finally, the court noted that when Congress intended to provide for attorney's fees in the Patent Act, It does so with clearly explicit language that is contained in several other sections of the patent law, and that because Congress failed to make its intentions similarly clear in Section 145, the court would not read the statute to contravene fundamental precepts of the common law. So, the court concluded that the history of the Patent Act also reaffirms the court's view that the statute does not specifically or explicitly authorize the PTO to recoup its lawyers or paralegals' pro rata salaries in Section 145 civil actions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.